Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas, this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their presentation, they are Lane Bank Equipment Company versus Smith Southern Equipment Incorporated from Harris County, National Liability and Fire Insurance Company versus Donald Allen from Angelina County, and Gulf Insurance and Select Insurance Company versus Burns Motor, etc. from Hidalgo County. In each of these causes, the court has allowed 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of our court. And we'll take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument. The arguments are being recorded by the clerk, and if you wish to purchase a tape, you may make application with the clerk's office. We are ready to hear oral argument from petitioner in Lane Bank versus Smith Southern.
May it please the court, Mr. Kronzer will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, I think we're here today not on the question of whether or not a trial court can sign or render or enter a second judgment, but the question of whether he can do so 35, 36 days after a final judgment based on this type of motion. And coming from Harris County, there is an inconsistency on how the two courts of appeals govern that county and other counties, and not only that, there's an inconsistency with how other courts and other jurisdictions have handled it. I believe that the Lane Bank, the Court of Appeals of Indian stands, is also inconsistent with what this court said several years ago in Scott and White Memorial Hospital in Schecksnyder.
Why don't you call it Scott and White?
When in doubt, use the first names of the parties, I think is how we're taught in law school. And is inconsistent with what that court said when discussing about a post-judgment motions for sanctions, the propriety of it, started off by saying that there are other motions that extend to trial court plenary jurisdiction. Those are not before us. We have this motion for sanctions. And other courts, Waco, Halmerson, the Dallas Court of Appeals, has also taken this position that there is no magic to a motion for sanctions. It is not a Rule 329B G motion that modifies, corrects, reforms a judgment.
It does change the judgment. I mean, if you're paying money out, it's all the same.
Well, yes, if you're having, in this case, a second document. I mean, for example, if it was just a motion for sanctions, and remember the trial court signed an order for sanctions the same day, and then in the final judgment, the recitation is very clear that the trial court is incorporating the earlier summary judgment and its signed order for sanctions. The trial court, within its plenary jurisdiction, clearly, based on Scott and White, could have signed an order for monetary sanctions, and it would be enforceable.
And Scott and White, that was the non-suit case, right?
It was.
So there was no judgment, right?
Well, yes, it was. The non-suit is, I mean, there was a final determination.
What final judgment did the court sign in that case?
Actually, if there was never a judgment signed, as I understand the facts of this case, there was a non-suit, and I believe it was a signed non-suit. I don't think we have that question of...
With that being the case, looking at the first line of 329BG, it talks about a motion to modify, correct, or reform a judgment. And it seems, just applying rules of English, that that would not apply to a non-suit situation. Would you agree with that? A motion for sanctions after a non-suit would not be a motion to modify, correct, or reform a judgment.
Yes.
In this particular case, however, there was a motion for sanctions filed and submitted to the court a judgment proposal which was different than the original judgment entered by the court, correct?
Yes.
And since it's a, since the judgment that was submitted to the court within the 30-day period was different from the original judgment, why would that not be categorized as a modified judgment?
Because I think, without trying to get into a form versus substance esoteric discussion, I think that we're not going to question of could it have signed a second judgment 29 days later and we'd be standing here. But when you read the motion for sanctions and entry of final judgment, there are 8 words that pertain to the proposed attached final judgment. It's not even mentioned in the conclusion. It's a motion for sanctions and, at best, a motion for entry of a final judgment. And I think, first off, Your Honor, I think that this might, it'd be fair to characterize as that by all appearances, this was one of those English versus Union State Bank, Mathridge versus Ross, that a summary judgment is granted. It's very clear that in the motion for summary judgment, they were addressing all causes of action. And in their conclusion, they asked for relief on all of the plaintiff's causes of action. That was granted.
And that was the original judgment?
The order.
The original order. And then the one that your opposition submitted to the court for the final judgment that was submitted to the court within the 30-day time period was a judgment that provided, in addition to granting them summary judgment, would also grant them over $40,000 in sanctions.
Yes, I don't disagree with the fact that this judgment, if it had been signed earlier, this isn't a McKay versus McKenzie situation, that if this had been signed on the 25th day after the first one, that it would not have been a subsequent judgment, it would not have been enforceable in and of itself. I think where I'm disagreeing with you, Your Honor, is that the specific words of 329, where they talk about motion to modify, correct, or reform, and the problem that the 1st and 14th Court and other courts have had with the 14th, is that you simply submitting a other judgment, according to some courts of appeals, isn't going to get you there to extend the trial court's plenary jurisdiction.
What if they had filed a motion and specifically asked for it to modify the original judgment and include sections?
I don't see any problem with that in extending the trial court's plenary jurisdiction.
So the real question here is whether we have that kind of motion or not.
I think so. If, in fact, this court is going to be consistent with Scott and White, that, and I'm not sure the first court agrees with this position, is that if this court starts with the proposition that, yes, a motion for sanctions, there's nothing magic about it, and it does not extend a trial court's plenary jurisdiction, the motion for sanctions portion, then this court, if that's true, if that's what Scott and White, you meant what you said, then I think the only way...
We didn't really say that, though.
Pardon me?
We didn't really say that. You have to take by the fact that we disapproved of another opinion and another part and didn't disapprove of it.
Well, I'll agree that the opinion didn't turn on it, Your Honor. But in the first couple of paragraphs, and I can't remember the exact words, it was talking about motions not at issue here extend the trial court's plenary jurisdiction. So if the court is talking about motions not at issue here extend the trial court's plenary jurisdiction, then motions at issue here do not. Now, that's an implication. I agree. But for some reason, this court started its opinion by saying, we don't have a motion that extends a plenary jurisdiction. Now, let's talk about whether or not the trial court can grant sanctions.
Well, rather than trying to decide if we can read Scott and White in a certain way, can define some principle out of it, like it was the law of the Medes versions, let's go back to first principles. Why shouldn't this type of motion come within Cheek versus Mitchell? I mean, what's different about it that it's worthy of a separate rule, whether or not we recognize that separate rule or not?
Well, I think in itself it's because it's going back to Scott and White and going with Cheek and going with McKay, is that if an order for sanctions had been signed within 30 days, it's very clear from Scott and White that that's enforceable. It doesn't need a judgment to hit up the people. So we know that you don't need a judgment to make a sanctions, a post-judgment sanctions, monetary sanctions, enforceable.
Why isn't a motion for sanctions a motion to modify the judgment?
Because you do not have to have a judgment. You simply have to have an order. And courts of appeals have distinguished between orders and judgments. And if, in fact, allow me to be both so bold, if, in fact, you have to have a judgment, then you could not have a final judgment if you had a pending motion for sanctions.
We know it doesn't have to be in a judgment, but we also know it can be in a judgment.
Right? Precisely. It can be. But the fact that it doesn't have to be.
But your rule would be anything that does, that doesn't have to be in the judgment and can be standalone. A motion made within the plenary jurisdiction to add that to the judgment must be acted on within the initial plenary jurisdiction or the trial court loses power.
Depending upon what else was said in the motion concerning the judgment.
Well, I'm just trying to get a kind of a neutral principle that will apply across the board. Because obviously the rule isn't crystal clear here.
Well, and I think the problem with crystal clear is if you look at Lane Bank and its predecessor Ramirez versus Williams Brothers Construction, and you look at the 14th opinion of First National Bank Freeport, Brazoswood, that they couldn't, those two courts couldn't even agree on whether this animal style, the motion to modify, was in fact a motion to modify. You had two intermediate courts of appeals looking, one who had to deal with it, and one later looking at that type of instances, disagreeing with its sister court, and you had much, much more aggressive, much more voluminous type of motion talking about this post-judgment filing, as opposed to what I would characterize as that this is a motion to enter a judgment. And I would put to this court that if a judgment is signed, 2 weeks later, I file a motion that says to the honorable court, please sign the attached judgment, respectfully submitted, Wally Cronson, that that's not a motion to modify. And the reason I would put that is because 329B could sure be written a lot clearer if that's all the rule was. Is that anything filed asking for a second judgment filed within 30 days, gets you an extension of plenary jurisdiction.
Your position is anything that asks for a second judgment within the time period then is a 329 motion?
No, I would say that if in fact this, because the only thing in this motion that dealt with a second judgment was simply the request to render the attached, comma, proposed final judgment.
But since that attached, it was a motion for sanction or rendition of final judgment with the attached, proposed, new judgment attached to it. So there was clearly a request that the judge do something to the judgment and sign a new judgment. Why doesn't that then suffice as a motion to modify?
I think two levels, Your Honor. One is, without saying the fact that courts of appeals can't agree on that, but I think that if that's all Rule 329B was ultimately trying to say, is then it's a very convoluted rule. If all you had to do, which is say, please sign the attached judgment.
Well, it's please sign the attached judgment, which includes changes from the earlier judgment.
Well,
that's really what, by looking at the judgment, you can see that it includes the sanctions that would be awarded if the court chose to grant the motion for sanctions. So by attaching it and saying, I know we have a judgment in this case, but please sign this judgment, which is different, doesn't that come within specific language of the rule that it is a motion to modify a previous judgment?
I don't think it does, Judge, and of course we don't have an opinion that says yes or no, and this court's going to have to do it. And
why not?
I think,
why doesn't follow that rule?
Because I think that the purposes of 329B, if you're talking about the motions to modify, correct, and reform, and I think how some of the courts have been talking about the substance of it, is the idea of assailing the judgment, and I think there's a certain feeling of notice to it. I think if 329 simply, if all it means is you really don't have to file, I mean, anything filed that would ask for a second judgment would be a motion modified. First off, I think we have a problem that this court has said, and I can't recall the opinion, kind of the check type cases, is that if you're simply filing a motion for a second date, that's not going to be good enough. So we can't simply say filing a second motion within trial court's plenary jurisdiction to get you an extension, because this court has differentiated between the judgments as whether it's a substantive change or material change. But this court has said that changing dates is not a material change.
Well, does it make any difference that this is a request for additional relief that the trial court did not have before it when it signed the first judgment? Does that make any difference that we now come in, for example, coming in and filing a new pleading post-judgment and saying, I'd like for you to now include the relief associated with this particular pleading that you didn't know about before? Does that make any difference under 329?
I think it does to some degree. It's almost kind of like getting back to Chief Justice Flip's things about what is a motion for sanctions, is what this judgment did was taking two existing acts and meld them together. It did not do anything differently than meld these existing acts together. And I will agree that in McKay versus McKenzie, you had that same situation where summary judgment had been granted, a non-suit was signed on the other cause of action, and 20-some-odd days, the trial court signed a final judgment that said, it's final. And I would contend that that wasn't necessary, but the trial court did. But the trial court clearly did within the plenary jurisdiction. That's not an extension of plenary jurisdiction case. That's simply when we start the appellate timetable.
Mr. Conjure, could you articulate what you say, accepting what 329B says, could you articulate a rule that would assist the courts to determine that this is something that seeks to correct or modify judgment and something that does not?
And I think in doing so, this court is going to have to clear up the discrepancy between the 1st and 14th court and other courts on form versus substance. And it could almost go back to those opinions and try to define what this was. I mean, what is a motion to modify? Because courts are looking at the same thing and can't agree. I think to say that it's a motion to modify, correct, or reform, I'll be honest with you, if in fact all you have to do is file please enter attached judgment, respectfully submitted, why are we bothering to have modify, comma, correct, comma, reform?
Well, didn't Chief basically do away with those distinctions and simply say if there's a correction of the judgment at all, it extends the appellate time to? Doesn't Cheek just really say, if what you're doing is saying do something different with this judgment, you've extended the appellate timetable, and after all, it's only a matter of 90 days or so, 105 days as opposed to 30, and it's not that big a deal?
On its face, it might not be, but again, Cheek was clearly done within the 30 days. Cheek is not was the trial court's plenary jurisdiction extended, was which judgment are we going to start counting from? And obviously, a trial court on sua sponte, regardless of motions within its plenary jurisdiction, can sign another judgment. It has that power under the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure. The question is, what motion that a party files kicks the appellate timetable longer and allows trial court to do things on the 31st day as opposed to the 30th day? And there is a distinction in the rules that trial courts can do things on their own without motions within 30 days. Cheat is a good example of that. not on its own motion, but that it could sign another judgment. I don't think Cheek is a motion to modify, reform, correct case for purposes of determining plenary jurisdiction extension.
So what should the rule be?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
You want to think about it for 20 minutes?
No, I'm I'm sorry. Is my time up? Or?
It's not as long as we have questions.
Okay.
But you can come think about it and come back on rebuttal.
No, I don't need to think about it. I'm sorry, Your Honor. I thought I was overstepping my welcome.
Go ahead.
To finish answering that question, I think that the motion that has to be filed, there has to be a motion. The rule is very specific. The trial court cannot extend its own plenary jurisdiction. That the motion has to be sitting there providing notice, and I would agree with the 14th Court of Appeals on this, that you don't have to, it's not the form, it's not if you called a motion to modify, it's automatically a motion to modify. But that have to point out why, what it is that we're doing.
Well, here there was a separate motion, quote, to enter a final judgment right there.
No, Your Honor, in the motion for sanctions and entry or rendition of the final judgment, at the last sentence of the first paragraph, it also included the words, Smith Southern moves for sanctions and rendition of the attached common proposed final judgment. In the conclusion of that motion, there is no mention of the judgment, which could open a whole line of questioning of, gee, do you have to pray for this animal for it to be a motion to modify? I mean, all they prayed for, if we're going to call a conclusion of prayer, is sign this sanctions order. I don't think we need to get into that argument of how specific a prayer is. But in their conclusion, they didn't ask for it, Your Honor. They said sign this sanctions order. And in passing, in the first paragraph, by the way, enter this judgment. And I just don't think that's a 329B motion to modify.
What if they had filed a motion for sanctions and then filed a separate motion to modify the judgment which said, in the event the court grants sanctions, please modify the judgment to include the sanctions order?
I think that passed the smell test.
What about this? The motion that was filed says defendant's motion for sanction and for rendition of the final judgment. What if they just styled it motion for sanction and for modification of final judgment?
And everything else stayed the same? Unlike Justice Hankinson's situation, I think they were getting more back to the form versus substance, and I still would be saying the same thing. It simply having modification of the title, as the 14th Court of Appeals said, isn't enough. You have to look at least to the body of the motion.
Could you tell me one more time why this is different than Justice Hankinson's hypothetical? The facts of this case.
Because they didn't ask for a modification. They just asked to sign this. I think this is more, Your Honor, the English versus Union State Bank, where they fought. They didn't think they had a final judgment. And by the way, while you grant the sanctions, here's a final judgment. And unfortunately, it's fortunate, depending on how you look at your position, the Court of Appeals have wrestled with a very clear demarcation that a final judgment is a final judgment. It doesn't matter what the parties think.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. The Court is ready to hear argument from Ms. Bob.
May it please the Court, Mr. Mings will present argument for the respondent.
May I please the Court? Initially, I'd like to apologize. I've been waylaid by a bug, and as a consequence, I'm about to lose my voice. So if I'm not heard well, please let me know, and I'll try to speak up. My comments are very brief. Our position, the respondent's position, I think, clearly set forth in our brief. I primarily would like to answer any questions that the Court might have about that brief. But
Mr. Mings, then let me ask you. I asked Mr. Conger for a rule, and it seems to me his rule that he proposes would have two parts. One is to avoid, and I don't remember the name of the case, I think Anderson was the name of it, to avoid the problem of a trial judge just arbitrarily extending the appellate timetable by entering a new judgment for no other purpose than extending the appellate timetable. Mr. Cronzer proposes a rule that says that a motion must be filed. And the second part, to have the motion be meaningful at all under 329B, it must at least be notice to the parties that a change to the judgment is being sought. What's wrong with that rule, and how would that apply in this case?
I must confess the significance of such a rule may be too subtle for me to pick up on. I frankly don't understand why such a rule would not result in the respondent prevailing in this matter. The respondent did within 30 days file a motion for a new judgment that included the relief earlier requested, with a slight modification of that relief, including a Mother Hubbard clause, which is unrelated to the sanctions, requesting additional sanctions.
But you did file a motion that requested additional relief that was not before the trial court at the time the trial court signed the original judgment.
Right, but there...
I mean, why doesn't that make a difference? Why isn't this something different when you come in and say to the trial court after the judgment has been entered, I know you took care of all this, Judge, that was in the pleadings, and you granted my summary judgment motion, but now I'm here, and what I want you to do is something else that you didn't have before you. Why is it that something different than a motion to modify?
A couple of reasons. First, the extension of plenary power with respect to the concept of modifying judgments, I think, is more generally related to the opportunity of the parties in the court to address, without the draconian threat of loss of plenary jurisdiction, any type of request after final disposition of the case.
Well, what if you filed an amended pleading at that point in time and went in and said, by the way, I'd like to have judgment on this particular claim. I forgot to put my medical expenses in, and here's my pleading on medical expenses, so now I'd like to have this additional relief, Judge. You've already given me the relief I wanted. Would that be a motion to modify?
I don't see any reason why it wouldn't be. It may not be a very meritorious motion, but the trial court needs to have the ability to consider whatever requests for relief are brought to its attention. And if a motion is filed 15, 20, 25 days after rendition of the judgment, and it is of such some kind of specific character that really doesn't affect the procedure by which the trial court would go about considering it, it puts the trial court in a very difficult position. And there's, as far as I know, really no authority to suggest that ought to be the rule.
We know this isn't a correction or a reformation, right?
I would respectfully disagree.
You think it's a correction?
It's a modification.
I understand, but
okay.
We've got three different things. We're looking for motions that modify, correct, or reform a judgment. This is not a motion to correct, right? Because you're not claiming there was a mistake in the original.
Right, I would say of those three, I would characterize it as a motion to modify.
Okay, and what does modify mean?
To change.
In any way?
Including
to grant additional relief that had not been previously requested.
Absolutely. In fact, if the change requested is not even substantial,
it could be material or immaterial. Just any kind of change.
Any change whatsoever. And that's clearly set forth in this court's holding in check. I think that's the case.
Well, what if your motion, and we've got some case law on this, we have case law that says that if your motion for sanctions was on file before the judgment was signed, not ruled on by the judge loses the power to rule on it after the 30 days.
Right.
But you're saying if we come in late on the 29th day and file the motion for sanctions, that suffices as a motion to modify the judgment in and of itself.
Absolutely. Rule.
It doesn't have to be a motion to modify or change the judgment. A motion for sanctions filed as such is sufficient because that means you're asking for additional relief.
I would say so. A couple of points on that. First, I think that Rule 329 on its face is constrained to those motions that are filed after the judgment. So the question of whether there might be some outstanding relief that wasn't addressed really doesn't extend the court's plenary power. And so that situation, a motion for sanctions or anything else that was pending prior to the rendition of the first judgment, certainly would not invoke any kind of extension of the court's plenary power. I think, generally speaking, considering that it is really a question of substance rather than form, that any kind of request.
So even if your motion had not included the language and for rendition of final judgment, and it only been styled the motion for sanction, that would be sufficient to comply with 329BG?
I would say so. But to be sure, that's not even the situation here. There was a specific request for rendition of a new judgment that had changes to it, albeit perhaps not substantial, to even the relief that was granted before.
Right. Now, I'm just trying to understand how your
sure.
rule would play out, since
sure.
you're focusing on the award of sanctions.
Yeah, I think that, you know, any suggestion that sanctions is of such special character that the trial court has some specially narrow emergency window in which it must deal with such a request, it's something for which there's no authority.
Why is it too much to ask for parties to have their motions unfiled and get them ruled on within 30 days after judgment? What's wrong with that? Why doesn't that help us further the finality of judgments and for a trial judge to be able to look at all the relief that's been requested within a reasonable period of time? Why is that a bad rule?
Well, even if the rule were that and the parties had this obligation that they get mailed some judgment, they don't know what day it's going to come out, they get the judgment, for whatever reason, they're on it, they open their mail, they immediately file some kind of motion for sanctions. That still gives the trial court only 30 days, which is a relatively short period of time.
Well, why shouldn't the party have the obligation? The pleadings have been unfiled in this case for a long time. The defendant was aware of the conduct of the lawsuit throughout. Why is it too much to ask the party to have their motion unfiled at an earlier point in time in litigation?
Well, it occurs to me that the propriety of seeking such relief kind of depends, in many cases, on whether you're entitled to judgment in the first place. Certainly in this case, it would have been premature to suggest to the court contingently that, you know, not only are we entitled to summary judgment, but we should have some sanctions as well. Probably a more orderly presentation would be to determine first whether the court agrees with the defendant's position on merits. I would like to address a couple of points. Very generally, I think that all of the cases that have been suggested to the court as representing some rule that plenary power is not extended by this motion really don't even address that question at all. There's no holding to that effect. There's no dicta to that effect. There's no suggestion. In particular, the Scott and White case, I just want to emphasize, really has absolutely nothing to do with the question that's before the court right now. The sole question there had nothing to do with the court's extension.
Do you agree that the gist of the cases that your opponent relies upon all seem to come down on the side of sanctions motions need to be dealt with within 30 days after a judgment?
Absolutely not. I would respectfully disagree with that position, as more particularly set forth in our brief. Every one of those cases is distinguishable, not on some fine point, but really the question was not even raised in those cases. For example, in Scott and White, the sole question in that case was whether the non-suit deprived the ability, deprived the defendant of the ability to seek sanctions at all. It wasn't a question of whether the request for sanctions extended some kind of timetable. As far as I recall, there wasn't even a timing issue involved in that case at all. There is some language that suggests something about, there might be some motions regarding extension of time that are not before this court. I think in context, that really simply means that here's something else that is clearly not an issue here at all. We're simply looking at the effect of a 162 non-suit on the ability to seek sanctions. And really, the case goes absolutely no further. There's no implication about anything concerning the extension of plenary power.
Mr. Mings, in answer to one of Hankton's questions,
sure.
The argument that a motion for sanctions that's pending before the judgment is entered is simply one of the claims for relief that gets overruled by the judgment, and merely because claims of relief aren't granted, that doesn't automatically extend the time for appeal of the judgment or the plenary power of the trial court.
Absolutely. If I understand, I'm sorry, Mayor.
Right. Well, but we do recognize that motions for new trials can be prematurely filed. The judgment hasn't been entered, but they know what's coming. And so they file a motion for new trial,
not knowing the judgment hadn't been entered. Then the judgment is entered, inconsistent with the request for the motion in trial. If we move away from a motion that assails the judgment to simply a claim for relief that would change the judgment in some way, do we create a problem where this jurisprudence that talks about a prematurely filed motion extends the appellate timetable?
Well, I must confess that I'm not, I'm generally familiar with that subject matter. I think it's distinct from the one to be addressed here. I would, off the top of my head, it occurs to me that where there is a request for a new trial or, I believe that was the question, correct, for new,
right.
new trial, that's clearly in a mistaken expectation that there's some judgment coming. There's not a situation where there's just some loose request for relief laying about that specifically contemplates this judgment, and there is no implication that it's been overruled by operation of the judgment. So I really don't think that's really a situation at all. And again, if I recall correctly, Rule 329 specifically, with respect to these motions to modify, apply to motions that have been filed after rendition of the judgment in question. So perhaps that language alone would sort of clarify the distinction there. There's been a suggestion that there's some split in the appellate courts concerning this issue, and I think that split the suggestion of it is illustrated by this first Freeport opinion in the 14th Court of Appeals and Ramirez opinion in the first. There is a distinction between those cases, but it's not one that bears materially on the issue that's before the court here. The dispute between those circuits relates to the suggestion by the minority courts to the effect that there's some need to go in and weigh the substance of these motions that are styled motions to modify. And in the first Freeport court case, for example, the issue there was that the request for relief was not really a modification at all, but simply a reversal fundamentally of what was requested before. And it wasn't merely a modification of the relief that was already granted. Here, in contrast, this is not the suggestion of reversal of what was done originally. It's a supplementation, augmentation of what was done before. I don't think that the first Freeport court would have a problem in doing exactly what the first Court of Appeals did in this case. You know, there is a dispute there, but it's outside the scope of the issue that's before the court here. If there are no further questions, I'm prepared to surrender the remainder of my time, but I am eager to answer any questions the court might have.
We'll take the time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Conger, would you say yes or no to this question? That a motion to change an existing judgment has to be meritorious before it would extend the time based on 329B.
Yes, it by definition meritorious that it was.
That you know you're going to get that.
Or in good faith, but you feel that there is a reasonable reason for you filing it. It may be that you don't have a snowball's chance.
Well, in this case, as you commented earlier, there's a one-line statement in the motion for sanctions, and please enter a final judgment in this case, which you could argue, well, that's no good because they already had a final judgment. Therefore, it doesn't operate to implicate Rule 329B. So why does it have to be a meritorious motion if you file things? I've got some more things to put in there, but you're wrong.
I guess I was speaking more to the ethical implications, Your Honor, that what you should file in court should always...
Well, I think most lawyers think everything they file is in good faith, you know, but they prove wrong sometimes.
I do agree that the motion that has to be filed seeking a change, modification, correction, or reform has to be valid. to create a change, but I think that in all fairness, going back to my analogy of please sign and close judgment respectfully submitted, doesn't meet the test of 329.
Just by virtue of that statement's in a transmittal letter.
The only reason it's not a transmittal is you sign respectfully submitted and put a certificate of service on it.
But there's no change. What if there's just a slight change? Would that be enough according to Mrs. Inc? It would be an immaterial change enough.
Well, I think that the check opinion sure says that there has to be a material. In other words, I think that the analogy, and I can't remember which justice we talked about, if the court on its own signed a judgment that was exactly the same and simply changed the date, that's not going to do it. And the court has said that. So the question is, what kind of change is going to get there? And actually, in check, that was a pre-judgment. There was some motion, I can't remember if it was the request for findings of fact or something, but there was a motion that was filed prior to judgment that this court said is effective at the time of judgment, even though it was prematurely filed. The problem is that, contrary to Mr. Meigs' statement, is that there are two givens. One is that there are courts of appeals that do not agree on what is a motion to modify.
What's wrong with the Corpus Christi's Court of Appeals opinion in Sheffield? They said, we're going to liberally construe the rule, and if the motion would result, if granted, would result in a change in the judgment, then it suffices under 329. What's wrong with that?
I think in the abstract there's nothing wrong with that. But again, as I recall from the actual physical motion that was presented in that, it was not simply please sign the attached, is that the sanctions went farther than that, and as I understand, was much more exhaustive.
But the court's holding was we're going to liberally construe the rule, and if the effect of the motion, if granted, is to change the judgment, that's good enough. We're not going to get into the fine-tuning of what they asked for. Motion would result in a different judgment if granted than the time fixed. What's wrong with
it? I don't think there's anything wrong with it per se, but the question is how do you get there? And the problem is if that is the rule, then the 14th Court of Appeals in the first report, when Mr. Mings had characterized it as a reversal, that they were asking for a judgment that was reversal, well, the first Court of Appeals said, well, isn't a reversal a materially different judgment? And I would say that if in fact the rule is simply that any new judgment that's different is a motion to modify, as opposed to correct it or reform, it's simply a motion to modify, then the rule can be better written. And that is the problem that this court has, is that the intermediate courts of appeals are not consistent on their application, Your Honor, of what is a motion to modify, and that this is not one, regardless of the justice.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first clause. The court will take a brief.
The audience will please rise.